Please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a trailer from our friend Steve at the podcast Fascination Street. Steve has talked to a ton of interesting folks. Some I found particularly fascinating were Ed Asner, Paul Feig, and Emma Fay Rudkin. You can hear a conversation Steve had with me in all my awkward glory on Fascination Street 2. Now on to the show.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
In 1974, the California Highway Patrol released a study entitled California Crimes and Accidents Associated with Hitchhiking. The study was not performed in Texas, of course, but the results are likely comparable to our state, and it seems to present the most comprehensive data available on the practice of hitchhiking in the time period. 106 different law enforcement agencies from across the state of California provided data. Some of the findings were obvious, such as the fact that an overwhelming majority of hitchhikers were more likely to be the victims of violent crimes than to be the perpetrator of such, and that female hitchhikers were much more likely to be victimized than males, 7 to 10 times more likely, in fact. A staggering 49% of hitchhikers who fell victim to a crime were 15 to 19 years old, a far larger percentage than any other age category. Another relatively common thought that is shown in the findings of this study is that around 80% of the crimes against female hitchhikers were sex-related. What is particularly striking about the findings of the study, however, is the fact that sexual assaults against female hitchhikers in the age group of 15 to 19 years old is by far the highest of all age groups and victims' sex. 14% of the victims of crimes in that age category were raped, with the second most common crime being attempted rape. Homicide of hitchhikers, though, falls into the crime category labeled other in the study. The reason it's lumped in, seemingly, is that the category includes a multitude of crimes in which the data is distinctively low for each. In other words, male or female, the study found that the likelihood of being murdered as a hitchhiker was extremely low. Galveston County, Texas, is on the coast of Galveston Island in Galveston County. The city serves as a port of entry and exit for products and goods shipping in and out. Galveston relies on tourism in a big way, but the local economy is kept afloat too with shipping and financial industries, as well as the largely attended University of Texas's Medical College, which in turn also serves as a major source of employment. As is the case with basically every coastal city in Texas, Galveston served as a haven for illicit activity and all-around debauchery shortly before and through the U.S. Prohibition era. Prostitution and illegal gambling popped up everywhere when the city was rebuilt following the hurricane of 1900, which decimated the town's structures and killed thousands upon thousands of residents. The Free State of Galveston, the name that stuck to the city during this period, wasn't meant to be, though, and by the 1950s, the town began settling into the industries that are prevalent there today. It's a beautiful place, the beaches are nice, and much of Galveston's early to mid-20th century architecture still stands. Many homes and businesses painted bright and colorfully, as is the norm for most coastal Texas cities. In 1960, the population of Galveston peaked at just over 67,000 residents. It's not gone that high since, and by 1970, that number fell to just under 62,000. The city's citizens thought of it as a relatively safe place to live at that point, though even after the exit of the illegal gambling industry, which of course involved organized crime figures, Galveston's crime rate has never been necessarily low. Violent crime, not uncommon. November 15, 1971, would prove to be a particularly and unfortunately horrific day for a few teenagers in Galveston. The Monday was unusual only for the fact that there was no school. Other than that, it was adolescent business as usual. At 10:55 a.m. that morning, 19-year-old Leslie White was hitchhiking her way down Seawall Boulevard on the coast. She stuck out her thumb at a green pickup truck. The driver moved to the shoulder as he braked, offering up the teenager a ride. Leslie climbed in, asking the driver of the westward-bound truck to drop her off at 27th Street. As they passed Leslie's desired drop-off spot, she pointed it out to the man driving, who refused to let her out of the vehicle, telling her he intended to drive her to West Beach, where he would rape her. Leslie wasn't having that, and as they reached 30th Street, she bravely leapt from the moving pickup truck. Two witnesses who'd seen Leslie make the jump stopped, picked the young woman up, and drove her to John Seeley White Hospital. Luckily, Leslie White only sustained minor injuries, bumps, and bruises in her courageous escape from the predator's grasp. A couple miles away, likely just prior to the attempted attack on Leslie White, best friends and fellow Ball High School sophomores, 15-year-old Debbie Catherine Ackerman and 16-year-old Maria Talbot Johnson, shopped at Port Holiday Mall, not far from the channel running between Galveston and Pelican Islands. Maria's boyfriend Bubba's birthday was coming up, so they hit the mall to look for a present for him. The pair were well-liked by peers and classmates. Debbie, considered by friends to be the more extroverted of the two teenagers, described as always laughing, talkative, and lively. And though Maria's disposition was more reserved than Debbie's, she was most often shy when meeting new people or upon first engagement in social situations. Friends say that once Maria got going, you'd be hard-pressed to keep her quiet. Both Maria and Debbie were beach girls through and through. They surfed, were experienced water skiers, and spent quite a bit of their free time on the beach and in the ocean. The two were said to have been inseparable, that you'd never see one without the other. Though it's difficult to imagine today, hitchhiking was extremely common in 1971, particularly among individuals in Debbie and Maria's age group. Debbie Ackerman hitchhiked often, according to many who knew her, although her father would later dispute those claims. Regardless, the two best friends decided they'd hitchhike to Houston on this Monday, about 50 miles from Galveston, according to a friend of theirs. 2 days later, on the afternoon of Wednesday, November 17, 1971, a man fishing a desolate, virtually untraveled canal that ran off Turner's Bayou in Texas City, near Turner Bridge, was shocked as he came upon a gruesome, unimaginable discovery. The body of a female who'd been bound at the hands and feet, with what has been described as both flashing cord and fishing line. The fisherman made his way back to a phone as quickly as he could to alert law enforcement to what he'd found. When police arrived at the scene and recovered the body from the dark, murky water, the cause of death was immediately obvious. The young woman had been shot twice, in the neck and head. It didn't take long to determine that the body was that of Maria Johnson, and police returned to the Turner's Bayou Canal the following day in search of Debbie Ackerman, since the two had last been seen together Monday, and both of the girls had been reported missing by Maria's mother at 9 p.m. that night. Maria's mother identified her body the same day police were searching for Debbie by a general description, her blouse, and a photograph of Maria, whose body is said to have been badly deteriorated even after only 2 days. The day was cold and wet, and rain fell consistently, but at 10:30 a.m., authorities were able to locate Debbie Ackerman's body on the side opposite of Turner Bridge, where Maria's body was found, and further down the bayou. She, too, had been bound and shot in the chin and back. Both girls were found naked from the waist down. Debbie's parents identified her late Thursday, the 18th of November. Autopsies were performed on the young best friend's bodies right away by Galveston County Medical Examiner Robert Buckland. It was Buckland's estimation that Maria and Debbie had been shot as they kneeled on the ground. He was unable to determine if either of the teenagers had been sexually assaulted at first, and would later tell reporters that, in fact, there were no signs of rape, but made the later determination that both girls engaged in sexual activity prior to being killed, saying that there was no bruising, no physical evidence that indicated sexual assault. Their bodies were estimated to have been in the water for 36 hours. Texas City Police Chief Rankin DeWalt, however, told the press, quote, "Sex is the only motive indicated," that he believed more than one individual was responsible for the slayings of Debbie and Maria. Chief DeWalt also pondered the connection to the murder of 14-year-old Brenda Jones, who was found floating in Galveston Bay the previous summer, bound by the feet and hands, shot several times, a slip stuffed in her mouth, saying, quote, "I don't know if there is any connection between this case and the Jones case. I understand there are similarities, however." In Harris County, investigator Hugh Irby wondered, too, about two unsolved cases there, the slaying of Colette Wilson and Gloria Gonzalez, telling reporters, quote, "We haven't established there is a connection, but there is nothing to rule it out." It was determined that the caliber of bullet used to kill Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson was .38, and upon investigation of the death scene, police found two .38 caliber shell casings and a pair of gloves. They also found a cattle gate that had been left open on the road to the scene. Galveston police moved quickly to collect witnesses to Debbie and Maria's last movements that Monday. It was already known to law enforcement that Debbie's parents last saw her on Sunday, November 14th, as the girls left to go out on a double date with a couple boys. After the date, Debbie returned home with Maria to spend the night, since there was no school the following day. They also knew that Maria's mother and stepfather had last seen both Debbie and Maria Monday morning as they left for work. The girls were seen at several shops in the mall that morning, according to witnesses who were also there. A woman came forward claiming to have seen two girls matching Debbie and Maria's descriptions getting into a pickup truck with a man on the beachfront near Seawall Boulevard, which presumably was particularly interesting to police, since Leslie White had escaped from such a vehicle around the same area after an attempted rape earlier in the day Debbie and Maria disappeared. Friends of the girls voluntarily took polygraphs and were cooperative with police, and at least one individual who was called a suspect took and passed a polygraph in Houston as well. Reward money offered for information leading to the conviction of Debbie and Maria's killer or killers grew, including $1,000 Maria's father put in. By the end of January, the fund had grown to just over $10,000. Police uncovered more clues as to Maria and Debbie's movements that day, but before going into those, it feels necessary to address a potential break in their case that occurred more recently. A Galveston investigator nearing retirement, Sergeant Fred Page, made an interesting discovery while looking into the long cold cases of Maria Johnson and Debbie Ackerman in 2005. A confession letter written to a Harris County district attorney by a convicted murderer named Edward Harold Bell. In August of 1998, Bell admitted to Debbie and Maria's murders in the first of several confession letters he sent to authorities in that year. Bell was in prison when he penned the correspondences, where thankfully he remains today, serving 70 years for the murder of 26-year-old Larry Dean Dickens, an ex-Marine, oil-filled roughneck, youth counselor, husband, and father of a 3-year-old girl. Larry Dickens' tragic death was the result of unmistakably brave and heroic actions taken against Bell, the account of which is described most accurately by court documents rather than the highly dramatized version of events later seen on season 5 of the television show Unsolved Mysteries. That's not to say the events of the afternoon of Thursday, August 24th, 1978, weren't dramatic in their actuality. In Pasadena, Texas, a suburban outlier of Houston, Larry Dean Dickens' mother, Dorothy, was at her home's kitchen sink when she noticed out the window a man, who would later be identified as Edward Harold Bell, stop and exit his red truck just across the street. Bell only wore a red shirt. He wasn't wearing pants, and his genitals were exposed. He approached a group of young boys, about 6 of them, and began masturbating. Although news outlets largely report that the children Bell approached were female, court documents clearly state that the children were males. Larry Dean Dickens had been outside his mother's home that day mowing the grass, but when he came in to get respite from the hot August day, he overheard Dorothy's call to police and took action. Larry sprinted outside the home to make sure Bell didn't get away before police could arrive, first snatching Bell's truck keys from the ignition. Bell demanded he return the keys, but Larry wasn't having it. Bell quickly obtained his jeans from the vehicle, slid them on, and produced a .22 caliber automatic pistol. He fired the weapon into the air, told the young man he'd kill him, to which Larry replied, "You're not going to kill anyone," as he approached Bell. Bell fired several shots into Larry Dean Dickens' body. Larry stumbled to the open garage of his mother's home, leaned against the washing machine, where Dorothy met him, having seen the situation play out from her window. She'd been on the phone with police the entire time, and in her haste to get her son, she'd dropped the phone's receiver, and the police operator remained on the line. Bell followed Larry into the garage, his pistol aimed at his head. Dorothy told Bell that the police were on their way, that he'd better leave, but he refused to flee until Larry returned his keys. Larry was severely injured by the gunshot wounds at this point, and most likely feared for the safety of his mother, so he relented, handing Bell the keys. Dorothy pleaded with the man to just leave and spare her son's life, but Bell shot him again anyway, this time in the head, turned around, and began making his way to the truck. Larry, amazingly, was still attempting to follow Bell and thwart his escape, but he was staggering and Dorothy laid him down just outside the garage on the driveway. At that very moment, Larry's sister Donna was at a stop sign at an intersection in view of the home. She witnessed Bell walk from the home's garage to his truck, produce a rifle, return to the driveway, aim the rifle toward the ground, and heard the weapon fire. When Donna pulled up, she saw that her brother was lying in the spot Bell had fired the rifle. He'd shot Larry Dean Dickens in the head again, at close range. These events all happened very quickly, within a couple minutes in fact, and police were en route. Officer Curtis Adams was in the process of responding to the call when he saw a truck matching the description of the vehicle involved in the event pass him by. He immediately turned around and pursued. The driver of the truck accelerated in an attempt to get away and, presumably on accident, turned into a cul-de-sac. Bell drove into a yard, stopped the vehicle at a fence, and tried to make his escape on foot, but Officer Adams produced his firearm and demanded he stopped. Bell did. When paramedics arrived at the scene of the shooting and sexually explicit exposure, Larry Dean Dickens couldn't be resuscitated and died in his mother's driveway. Edward Harold Bell was taken into custody and charged with murder and indecency. State District Judge Thomas Rout ordered that he undergo a psychiatric evaluation and set bail at $125,000. Bell made bond the day after his arrest, on August 25, 1978, paying a little over 30% to a bondsman, or $40,000. Pasadena and Houston residents were furious at Bell's release and stormed a Houston courtroom, but it was too late. Bell immediately began cashing in assets. It is reported that he was able to obtain about $140,000. He fled, neglecting, of course, to appear in court to stand trial on Monday, January 8, 1979. Edward Harold Bell evaded justice for almost 15 years, despite the Texas Department of Public Safety's efforts to highlight him as a most wanted fugitive for years, coming in at the number one spot in January of 1985. Law enforcement finally tracked Bell to Panama City, Panama, after tips they received upon the original airing of a television episode of Unsolved Mysteries on December 2, 1992. He was arrested in Panama City by authorities there and subsequently extradited back to the United States. Bell was put on trial and convicted for the murder of Larry Dean Dickens. At the trial, he took the stand to testify on his own behalf, his version of what happened on August 24, 1978. His testimony strikingly different from every other witness whose accounts all corroborated one another. His account, perhaps, a glimpse into the bizarre mechanics of his mind and future actions he'd make and lies he would tell. Bell told the court, basically, that the first shots fired upon Larry were in self-defense, as Larry continually beat him and he could not retreat, and that the last shot, the rifle shot, was the result of himself tripping and accidentally discharging the weapon, a cowardly attempt at lessening his fault in the murder of Larry Dean Dickens. While serving his 70-year sentence, Edward Harold Bell began penning letters to both Harris County and Galveston County district attorneys, starting with the confessions to the murders of Maria Johnson and Debbie Ackerman. Bell ultimately admitted to a total of 7 homicides of young women and girls in these letters, though he would later own up to a total of 11 murders in correspondence with journalist Lisa Olson. Bell's trouble with the law began long before he coldly and disconnectedly shot and killed Larry Dickens, going back to the year 1969, including charges such as aggravated sexual assault and an abundance of counts of indecent exposure to minors. Bell was more often than not merely slapped on the wrist for these atrocious and despicable acts, simply ordered into mental health facilities usually, and was sometimes even able to talk responding officers out of arresting him. He worked many years as a pharmaceutical salesman whose territory stretched from East Texas into Louisiana, providing him ample opportunity to victimize children. He described himself as a roaming pervert. He was considered a naturally adept business person and intelligent, The surf shop he co-owned on Galveston Island called Doug's Dive and Surf was a draw for young people, children, and adolescents. His partner Doug said Bell hardly came around the store, and when he did, he was only there for an hour or two at a time. At least one individual who worked at the surf shop, though, also described Bell as a con man. And to get back to the letters, that description tends to explain much of the breadth of his writings to authorities, which are latent with conspiracy theory and self-victimization. I have decided to tell you that I was brainwashed into killing Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson in November 1971, the first letter begins. Bell goes on to talk about something called the program, some sort of torture and mind control government project that was started by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The bulk of his ramblings on the subject are just too much to delve into here, but at their core, as mentioned above, is how Bell explains away his guilt of the murders he confessed to while contradictorily explaining away those confessions as false, a product of the program. And, as is predictable with a driveling, nonsensical recreant like Bell, a way to portray himself as the actual victim of his own heinous actions. He blamed everyone but himself, from his father to his Boy Scout troop leader, all part of the underground program that conditions people over the entirety of their formative years to be rapists and murderers. It's a mess, a pathetic mess, and brings to mind the surf shop employee that called him a con man. In his series of letters to author Catherine Casey, Edward Harold Bell speaks of the program, but also offers the true crime writer the location that he picked up Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson. He told Casey he picked the girls up in front of a Baskin-Robbins ice cream store on University. Bell claims to have had sex with Maria and that she was wearing a purple dress. He says he took Debbie and Maria 15 miles north of Texas City to a wood bridge. A friend of Debbie and Maria saw them that day when they came in to the Baskin-Robbins, of which she was an employee, and told authorities that, though she couldn't remember what Debbie wore, she distinctly remembers that Maria was wearing a white blouse and red pants. She said they told her they were hitchhiking to Houston that day and saw them get into a white van after speaking with the driver. Baskin-Robbins was located on Holiday, not University, and obviously Bell puts Maria in clothes she actually wasn't wearing. But an employee of the surf shop Bell was invested in does remember him owning a white Ford van, and Bell was arrested in February of 1972 in a white Ford van after exposing himself to two young girls. One witness account, however, an account that Galveston Police Captain Everett Walker said, quote, "looks real good," came from a cab driver. According to the cab driver, he drove both Debbie and Maria back to Galveston from Texas City that Monday evening. The account seems credible. It would have been a decent, memorable fare for the man, as Texas City is 20 miles away, and for the fact that Debbie, the cabbie claims, left her purse in his taxi. And further, it appears that investigators were able to trace the girl's steps and confirm that the purse was claimed by Debbie at 8 p.m. in Galveston. Several of these details have been left out of reports in recent years, possibly because they are in stark contrast to Edward Harold Bell's confession. Bell ended up recanting on his confessions, all of them, blaming the program, seemingly, but still insisted that Debbie and Maria entered his van because they were tired of boys their age and wanted to have sex with an older man. Bell claims they wanted to have sex with him. While many current programs and reports insist that Edward Harold Bell is a serial killer of epic proportions, he seems little more than a sociopathic con man and coward. His mental health issues probably don't go too far beyond that. Debbie Ackerman's mother and father continued to publicly seek answers in their daughter and Maria's murders. They kept all of Debbie's belongings and visited her grave every Sunday and Wednesday. "I've got to find this guy. It keeps you going. I want to find out who could have done this horrible thing. Nobody knows how it hurts," Joe Ackerman, Debbie's father, told a reporter in 1986, adding, "Just sitting by your grave makes me feel good. It comforts me, relaxes me." For almost 30 years, they put a memorial notice in the papers on the anniversary of Debbie's death. They both died never knowing what happened to their daughter and her best friend, never seeing justice brought to the killer or killers. As for Edward Harold Bell, who has never been charged with one of the 11 murders he confessed to, the former Galveston County District Attorney, who filed away Bell's confession letter, told former homicide investigator Fred Page on the A&E series The 11, quote, "After receiving this letter from Bell, where he says he participated in the murder of 7 people, I pulled together my chief investigator to go interview him in the penitentiary. Unfortunately, when they went, he gave them no information and refused to talk to them. I've handled many capital murder cases, many serial rapists, and I can tell you that they are sick puppies. Anybody that reads this letter, you don't have to be a trained psychologist, could say this guy's weird and there are wires that are definitely not connected." At that point, we were not going to go forward with anything. If you've been around it long enough, you have a feel for it, and I just don't think that he did it. You know, you do have to trust your judgment. On Saturday, April 20th, 2019, after we wrote and recorded this, Edward Harold Bell died at the age of 82 in the Wallace Pack unit of the Texas Penitentiary System in Navasota. If you have any information about the homicides of Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson, please contact Texas Crime Stoppers by calling 713-222-TIPS. That's 713-222-8477. You can remain completely anonymous. Don't forget to stick around to the end to hear a trailer for the podcast Fascination Street. The Galveston Daily News, the Houston Chronicle, the Amarillo Globe, the Odessa American, the A&E television docuseries, The 11, and KatherineCasey.com were used as sources for this episode. If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. There are several varying donation levels to choose from, with perks to go along with each, including ad-free listening at all levels. Donations help us cover the costs of research and production, and we can't thank y'all enough for your support. Another great way to support the show is to leave a rating and review on iTunes or wherever else you listen to the show. It helps guide more folks our way. And if you're interested in reading about true crime, check out our go-to spot on the web, thetruecrimefiles.com. There are tons of well-presented cases there, many unknown or ignored by the media. There are book reviews, podcast reviews, and guest posts. TheTrueCrimeFiles.com is an amazing resource for learning about cases you might not be aware of otherwise. Check it out. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Hey guys, this is Steve Owens from Fascination Street Podcast here with a very important message. I'm awesome. I bet you thought I was going to say something else, but nope. What's important here is that I am awesome. I have a podcast called Fascination Street, and it allows me to bring to my listeners some of the most fascinating stories and guests. I started this show because I truly believe that everybody has a story, and I'm fascinated to hear those stories. In the short time I've been doing this show, I've interviewed actors, directors, writers, inventors, podcasters, musicians, pro athletes, Olympic athletes, actual war heroes, even a Bond girl and a luthier, whatever the hell that is, and of course, regular people. From people who wanted to be stars but never gave it a real try, to big company CEOs and people who got to meet their favorite president. I love getting to meet and speak with people who have a story to tell. I feel like everyone does, and it's my job to get them to tell it. You never know who my next guest will be. An Academy Award-winning actor, a platinum-selling musician, or your own mother-in-law. But one thing is for certain, you will be fascinated by their story. So come take a walk with me down Fascination Street. You can find this show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and of course, FascinationStreetPod.com.